Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the 90s podcast, an aviation podcast, season number 2, episode 1. Today's episode special guest is Andrew Neofitu. Andrew Neofitu is a former Royal Navy Sea Harrier pilot. He transitioned into the world of commercial aviation in 2006, operating the Boeing 757, 767, and the Airbus A320 family and A330 with Thomas Cook Airlines, before joining a major UK legacy airline as a Boeing 787 pilot. Besides flying, Andrew is the founder and director of Flight Deck Wingman, a company dedicated to preparing pilots for recruitment processes. He's as well the host of the podcast For Flying Out Loud. And now, without any further ado, Andrew. So, you joined the Navy back in the 90s, right?
Yes, yeah, end of 96, 97 time, yeah.
Yeah, why the Navy?
The Navy, well, it's a good question. For me, I guess, you know, the Air Force had so many more aircraft than visibly in terms of military aircraft than the Navy, particularly fast jets, because at that time the Air Force were flying the Tornado, the Jaguar, the Harrier, the Typhoon was coming online. So there's a lot more exposure to military fast jet flying when you see the Royal Air Force. And I didn't actually know, believe it or not, even though the Falklands conflict, which featured the Sea Harrier back in 1982, I didn't actually know that the Navy flew fast jets, which I'm ashamed to say. And after leaving university, I applied to the Royal Air Force and I wasn't successful. And, you know, quite a trying time that when you got this dream and then you're not successful in applying to join the Air Force. So I started looking at the Royal Navy to fly. I knew that they did fly, but it was only at that stage that I knew that they flew fast jets as well. And having been unsuccessful with the Air Force, I tried my chances with the Royal Navy and was successful. And in fact, managed to come top of my class in officer training and obviously went on to fly fast jets for the Royal Navy. So it's funny how life works out sometimes, isn't it? And I was a member of the Air Cadets, so the sort of Air Force cadet organization when you were at school. But no Navy connections at all. And in fact, my surname, Neofitu, I'd be surprised if there are any other Neofitus have ever either joined the Royal Navy or are currently in the Royal Navy. So perhaps yeah. I'm the only one, but no attachment at all. In fact, my dad was a doctor and he had his private pilot's license, which is, I think, where I got my initial interest in aviation, but no connections to the military nor the Royal Navy.
Okay, yeah. So you had, an aviation family background due to your father?
Yeah, purely because of his love of private pilot flying. And of course, in 1986, when Top Gun came out, I was 11 years old. That was all the inspiration anyone really needed to want to go and be a military pilot. But I guess even then, although on Top Gun, it's quite obvious they're flying from aircraft carriers, still didn't make the same connection with the Royal Navy until the story I told you before.
Especially because you guys, you don't have, the same type of aircraft carrier than the US have or than the French have. It's more like the aircraft carrier than the Marines use in the US, right?
Exactly. The same as a US LPD with the AV-8B Harrier, yeah, that the US Marines fly. And in fact, the latest carriers, as you know, to join the Royal Navy, HMS Queen Elizabeth and HMS Prince of Wales, both of those are still designed around V-STOL aircraft, so the F-35B variant, the V-STOL variant. So I think the last time that we had cat and trap, same as the French Navy and US Navy, was around the 1970s before a big defence cut. But I actually had the chance to go and look around HMS Prince of Wales a few months ago, and just a completely different league to HMS Invincible that I served on. Vast aircraft carrier, obviously comparative size. Even the aircraft hangar was just huge. And of course, stepping out onto the deck, although the ski jump was still familiar, it was a much bigger deck with two towers on the aircraft carrier rather than just one small deck with one tower. So yeah, it's amazing to see this new technology arrive into the Royal Navy and secure the future of naval aviation in the UK, which is fantastic.
Yeah, exactly. That was my question. Two towers. Do you know why two towers? I think there is one for the ship maneuvers and the second one for the air maneuvers, but perhaps I'm wrong.
No, that's correct. Well, that's what I was told by my old oppo, who's the commander on the ship. And yeah, the front tower, as I believe, was, yeah, as you say, ship maneuvers, so that where the captain sits and where all the sort of driving the ship happens, and Flyco, where all the air operations run from the rear tower. But I'm assuming there might be some sort of redundancy if one tower was, you know, taken out or had a defect. But I don't know for sure. But yeah, I think it's a great idea. And putting the second tower near amidships, at the middle of the aircraft carrier, is probably a really good idea as well. Better overview of what's happening on the deck.
Yeah, exactly. So backing up a little bit, so you flew the Haya for the Royal Navy. First of all, after getting your wings, your fighter pilot wings, do you have the choice to go to the Haya or to something else?
So the only fast jet that the Royal Navy had when I was going through training was the Sea Harrier. And we were actually streamed either fast jet to fly the Sea Harrier or to fly rotary wing aircraft at the end of elementary flying training, just the single engine piston flying training. So I was one or two out of about 20 pilots that were streamed the fast jet route. And the only option was to go to the Sea Harrier. So the inference there is that at any stage through basic fast jet training or advanced fast jet training on the Hawk, if you didn't make the standard, you would be chopped. There would be no Sea Harrier flying, and you would return to the Royal Navy as a rotary pilot. And that historically is what happened. Interestingly, around the time that I was going through training, we did have quite a handful, I would say, of pilots, Royal Navy fast jet pilots, that weren't making the grade to fly the Sea Harrier going through fast jet training. And they were taken on by the Royal Air Force to fly the Tornado, both the F3 and the Tornado GR4, as Navy pilots, although some of those pilots decided to join the Royal Air Force and have a fuller career, I guess, with the Royal Air Force. But yeah, it was an unusual time. But I suppose when you look at it, if you've taken someone quite a long way through fast jet training and it's cost probably even halfway through that training a couple of million pounds, it seems a bit silly if they're good enough to fly a two-seat aircraft or something that wasn't the Sea Harrier. Why not allow them to fly something different but still a fast jet? So I think it was a really good decision. And quite a few of my colleagues did that and had great careers in the Royal Air Force. And some of them did return to the Sea Harrier and ultimately the Harrier GR9, having flown the Tornado, and were exceptional pilots on the Harrier then.
Yeah. Do you fly some cat and traps training, for example, flying the T-45 Gauche Oak in the States, or do you fly your own training in the UK of flying the Hawk?
So there was, because the Harrier was purely V-stall aircraft, so vertical landing on the ship, there was no cats and trap operation. I think the only sort of cat and trap equivalent in the UK is if there's an emergency with a tornado, for example, and they had the hook at the back to stop. But no, there was no cat and trap operations, because that's not what we do in the UK. But having finished advanced flying training and tactical weapons training on the Hawk, we then moved into the Sea Harrier phase. But before getting to the Sea Harrier, we spent a week at a rotary training base for the Royal Air Force and the Royal Navy, flying at that time the Squirrel helicopter. So we had 5 hours of helicopter flying, which I really loved, actually. It was an amazing week. And, you know, very first flight, getting to hover taxi. I think on the second flight, I flew a couple of auto rotations. So I really enjoyed that course. And it was needed, because the second solo in a Harrier is a vertical takeoff to hover. So you needed that bit of practice before you did it in the Harrier.
Yeah, I can imagine. Do you have twin-seaters, Harriers, or do you have only single-seaters in the Royal Navy?
Yeah, so there were twin seat aircraft, yes, and a simulator. So the sim was single seats. The T-8 Harrier, and of course the Sea Harrier, and well, all Harriers have left the Royal Navy now, but we had a two-seat T-8, it was called, and that was used for mainly the V-stall type training, and occasionally for other elements of training through the Harrier OCU. But we had two flights in the in a two-seat Harrier, a couple of simulator flights, and then our first solo, which really, thinking about it, was mind-blowingly small amount of training before stepping into a single-seat fighter. And then the following flight from your first solo was again back into the two-seat Harrier to do what they call press-ups, so three vertical takeoffs and landings in the two-seat aircraft. And then your second ever solo, like I said, was a vertical takeoff in a single-seat aircraft, again to do three takeoff and landings, vertical takeoff and landings. And it was a bit of a general navigation exercise around the southern part of the airfield, just while I tried to get this thing stable in the hover and then stable enough to descend and land. Because if you land with any sideways movement, you often break the outrigger wheels, the small wheels on the wingtips.
It should be very astonishing the first time you hover on an aircraft that is a fighter jet.
It's incredible, yeah. And fairly quickly you get used to the hovering regime, but the most challenging and dangerous part of the hovering flight is that transition to hovering flight and transition away from hovering flight into normal forward flight. So as you leave any wing-borne lift and move to the hover, several things can go wrong. And one of them, I still don't understand the physics behind it, but there was a phenomenon called intake momentum drag. And if you weren't pointing into wind as you decelerated down to the hover from forward flight, the aircraft would, due to this drag within the intake of the engine, rapidly yaw, and of course then rapidly roll and be upside down within a couple of seconds. And I think in the early years of flying a Harrier, there were a lot of people killed in that type of regime. And the same is true as you accelerate away from the hover. And in fact, I nearly did crash, I think, on my first ever acceleration away from a hover. The instructor had said to me, whatever you do in the Harrier, if something goes wrong, undo the last thing you did. So I'd move the nozzle lever from the nozzles pointing down and move the lever forward to move the nozzles gradually aft to accelerate away from the hover. But I did it a bit too quickly because I was so focused on keeping the aeroplane into wind and I felt myself sinking. So I rapidly moved the nozzle lever back to the hover stop and went vertically upwards at quite some speed. So anyway, I got away with it. And there were plenty of opportunities to kill yourself in a Harrier. I think that's safe to say.
Do you have something like special controls to control the Harrier doing the hover maneuver or the vertical takeoff or vertical landing? Or do you control every movement of the aircraft through the stick you have?
Yeah, so the Sea Harrier was sort of first generation Harrier, so there was very little in the way of stability augmentation. The later Harriers, the GR7, GR9, had more stability augmentation, and although I never flew it, I know they had a flap system called, I think they call it, I'll be corrected now by all the Harrier guys listening, stall flaps, but essentially some automatic movement of the flaps with the nozzle lever. But in the Sea Harrier, there was nothing like that, so very limited stability augmentation, and everything was flowing through the stick, and a combination of moving the throttle and the nozzle lever, and occasionally moving very quickly between the throttle and the nozzle lever. I'd say quite a challenging aeroplane to fly, particularly in this transitioning from hovering flight. And I know that obviously now the technology moves on. The F-35, one of my close friends was one of the lead test pilots on the F-35 program and the first, in fact, to land it on HMS Queen Elizabeth. And he explains that the F-35, whereas in the Harrier, if we wanted to slow down to hovering flight, we would gradually move the nozzles downwards as we approach the hover and start increasing the thrust, of course, to have enough thrust pointing down to keep us in the hover. But in the F-35, as they want to enter the hover, they literally close the throttle and you're essentially telling the aircraft you want to fly at 0 knots. So it just slows down to 0 knots and you maintain your altitude using the stick, but you leave the throttle closed. And it goes, well, you want zero forward speed, so I'll give you zero forward speed, which is completely counterintuitive to a Harrier pilot. So he told me it took a bit of getting used to when he moved to the F-35.
Yeah, I can easily imagine. Do you use sometimes the hovering capabilities in basic fighting maneuvers, for example?
Yes, there was, and there was lots of talk. I remember when I started on the Harrier about, you know, this amazing ability to use the nozzles in air combat. The problem, of course, is with no reheat, and you'll know that as a Mirage 2000 driver, that, you know, there was no way for us to regain energy, really, especially at any sort of altitude. Although the Harrier was a very powerful aircraft, particularly at low level at altitude without any burners, there was no way to gain any energy back. So if we did use the nozzles for any sort of maneuver, it was a sort of a one-stop maneuver. The only one that particularly could work, if you could force, for your listeners out there that have obviously flown air combat, if you could force a fly through from one of the other aircraft and then pitch the aircraft up into a barrel roll maneuver, and as you get towards the top of the barrel roll, move the nozzles towards the hover stop to essentially slow right down, slow your movement as you're upside down, to kill your forward movements. And in fact, bring the nozzles towards the braking stop, so slightly forwards. So you force the fly through and you increase the amount of fly through of the other aircraft by slowing down at the top of the barrel roll. Occasionally that would work. But of course, if you got it wrong, you've killed even more energy and you're a sitting duck. Mm-hmm. So, occasionally, if you needed just that extra 10 degrees of pitch to get the winders onto the other aircraft in a single circle fight, you could pull the nozzle levers, just give them a bit of a kick backwards, and that would just kick the nose of the aircraft upwards slightly. Might mean that you could bring the missile onto the other aircraft, but again, it killed energy, so it wasn't something that I used a lot personally.
Yeah, perhaps as well, you have the missile limitation. The main speed missile limitation that should be not 0 knots. I don't think so.
Well, correctly. Yeah, correct. Yeah, absolutely. And certainly for the AMRAAM missiles. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. You don't want to flame the engines out.
Exactly. So did you, I'm sure you deployed a lot flying the Haya. Do you have some war missions?
No, so for me, the last time the Sea Harrier was used in combat was around 1997, and that was during the Bosnia conflict. Mm-hmm. And in fact, one of the Sea Harrier guys, Nick Richardson, was shot down during that conflict in the Sea Harrier. But after that, the Sea Harrier wasn't used right up until its retirement in 2005. And although a handful of Sea Harrier pilots, in increasing numbers, started moving toward the GR9, I didn't, for various reasons. So I never saw combat, although obviously I did embark. And if the case, as you know, with so many military pilots, some never get to see combat, and sometimes you end up in a period of time where there's lots of action. But personally, no, I didn't.
Okay, yeah. And then afterwards, after the higher time, you transitioned to the civilian life.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, absolutely. So I moved to the airline world in around 2006. And I've been flying in the airlines now for approaching 15 years. But I, do you know what, Matthew? I really enjoy all aspects of aviation. So I feel incredibly lucky to have had my time flying fast jets, particularly to fly the Harrier. But yeah, I've been in the airline world for 15 years, and I really, really enjoy my time in the airlines.
Yeah. So you began with Thomas Cook.
Yes, yeah. So I was with Thomas Cook for almost 10 years. That was a sort of holiday company, and I got to fly the 757 and 767 and the A320 and A330. Do you know what? A really great company. For anyone that knows about Thomas Cook, sadly, they went into administration the year before last, at the end of 2019. So many amazing people there that lost their jobs tragically, and a lot of pilots still affected, of course, because they lost their job and then entered straight into this current COVID situation. But a really, really great company. I loved my time there, and I had some great trips, you know, long haul trips with these sort of holiday airlines back in the early 2000s, mid 2000s were fantastic. Weeks in Montego Bay in Jamaica, and, you know, just having a great time, really.
And lucky you, because you flew a lot of type of aircraft, from the Boeing 757, 767, the A320 family, and the A330. That's awesome to have this experience on those type of aircraft.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, the the guy that helped me out with my first airline job gave me a bit of advice. He said, never, ever turn down a free type rating. You never know when you might need it. And that's so true. And in fact, I followed that and I went from the Boeing to the Airbus back to the Boeing. And I think that then helped me with my current airline, who I can't talk about, but I think it helped me get my current position flying the 787. The fact that I managed to keep all these ratings and experience valid.
Okay, so the question, Airbus or Boeing?
They say for every Airbus action, there is for every Boeing action, there's an Airbus overreaction, is what they say. But I should say Airbus speaking to a Frenchman, shouldn't I? But personally, I prefer the feel of flying what feels like a real aircraft, I suppose, in how it handles. And you get a lot more of that with a Boeing. But the Airbus tech, that sort of first-gen airline fly-by-wire tech, now integrated into a 787, for example, which still feels like a normal aircraft, but it's got all this clever fly-by-wire tech working in the background. I think, personally speaking, I've not flown the A350, but the 787 is sort of like the best blend of all the good bits of Airbus and all the good bits of Boeing. So I'm a Boeing guy, I'm afraid.
Yes, because on the versions of the 757 and 767, you didn't have any fly-by-wire.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but it's amazing, really. I remember doing the base training, you know, when you do takeoffs and landing circuits in the 757, and just feeling like I was wazzing around in a Harrier flying downwind. It's sort of same sort of handling, really. It was I really enjoyed it, and that sort of that feeling of just flying a normal aircraft. Yeah, absolutely. And the same is true with the 787. But you know, with the 787, there's so much more stuff happening to help you out that makes it so much easier. Particularly the head-up display, of course.
Yeah, it's the same story I have as well. I did my all my visual patterns flying the A330 in Macau, and I was, lucky me, the only trainee. So I had the opportunity to fly from Hong Kong to Macau and Macau to Hong Kong. And it was very kind of weird because I flew the Alpha Jet before, and it's traditional controls, and switching to Airbus, the A330. At that time, it was complete fly-by-wire controls and not even the same than the Mirage I flew before. So it was a bit of shock when you don't fly a lot the aircraft. I mean, every action you do, there is a counteraction, and I totally agree with you with that.
I have to ask you, Matthew, if you don't mind, one of my favorite displays, particularly at the International Air to Two in the UK, was watching the Mirage 2000. And I don't know who displayed that aircraft, if you displayed it, but the G and the sustained G that it was quite evident that aircraft was pulling, it looked like a really capable aircraft. What would you say?
Yeah, it's a really capable aircraft. I agree 100% with you. I didn't display it, but I had the opportunity to do a lot of basic fighting maneuvers and a lot of low-level maneuvers as well. And it was a very nice aircraft. And the fly-by-wires, especially when you fly it, were amazing, really. It was just, pure fly-by-wires, and it was always smooth. You don't have any holes in the envelope, in the fly-by-wire envelope, on where you are not comfortable. You are always comfortable with the fly-by-wires, and it's very smooth and easy to pilot, as long as you don't screw up during the flare maneuver on landing. Because you land the aircraft at 14 degrees AOA, and you don't have a lot of space between the nozzle and the ground when you land the aircraft. So this is sometimes the issue, but as long as you don't screw up this phase, you are able just to fly the aircraft very smoothly, as long as you stay in the envelope.
Have a go in one of those. In fact, talking about the Alpha, I think we used to fly a conventional approach in a Harrier if the nozzles for some reason didn't move, but it was a pretty scary approach, very fast. And 12 Alpha, I think we flew it at, but very, very close to the aircraft departing, and a scary fast approach speed, and something with these wheels stick on the wingtips.
Yeah, around 180 knots, something like that.
Well, yes. In fact, I had an engine failure in a Harrier, and managed to restart it. I only got one engine, of course, like the Mirage, and in fact, I couldn't bring the nozzles to the normal position to land. what we normally fly, what we call a nozzly approach, so fixed power variable nozzle approach. But I couldn't bring the nozzles down to the normal angle for that type of approach because the engine wasn't producing enough power. So I flew a sort of in between a conventional and a nozzly approach to land, and the threshold speed was 180 knots, and the tire limiting speed for the outrigger wheels was 180 knots. Any faster, they would burst. So it was a bit nail biting, having gone through this emergency, then coming over the threshold at 180 knots, thinking, "I hope the wingtip wheels don't burst." That was an interesting day out.
Do you have some barriers in the UK?
There are barriers, yeah. The Sea Harrier couldn't take the barriers. The canopy wasn't strong enough to withstand it, unfortunately, so it would have been ejecting.
Oh, yeah, you only have this option, the ejection.
Correct, yeah, yeah. No one wants to use that option, really, do they?
Yeah, hopefully. And this is the option you have that you don't have in an airliner.
Yeah, correct. But then we've got two engines in an airline. And
This is the point I've noticed flying fighters and flying commercial aircraft, is that in commercial aircraft, all the systems are twice more redundant than in a fighter jet. And I think it's, of course, for the safety of the passengers.
Yeah, absolutely. Or even three times as much. And the tech's moved on so much now. And the 787, the electronic checklists, provided you follow them in the way that Boeing intended you to follow them, they're amazing. I mean, you know, I think about my tech knowledge that I had to have of flying the 757 compared to the tech knowledge I need to operate the 787. You don't need as much tech knowledge. Of course, more of it is about the operational procedures because the aircraft is so much more capable. You know, we can fly single engine Cat 3 approaches in the 787, whereas we couldn't do that in a 757, of course. So the knowledge of what you can do with the aircraft, I think, is increased in the 787, but the sort of technology you need is, I would argue, far less important.
Yeah, right. Besides flying in your current company, I know you own a business. Can you tell us what's the kind of business you own and why did you open this business?
Yeah, so my company, I formed around 5 years ago. And actually, because I left the Royal Navy slightly earlier than usual due to some problems with my back, I had lots of friends essentially a few years later that were leaving the forces and looking to join the airlines. And of course, you know, as well as I do, ex-military pilots like to ask often get asked by their friends that are leaving, you know, can you help me? What should I expect from my assessment process? And what do I need to know? Because it's a completely new environment. So I started my new company combining the flight deck of an airline with being a wingman in the military. And my company, Flight Deck Wingman, was born. And we initially specialized in helping military pilots transition to civilian life as pilots. But since 2016, when it was formed, we've helped hundreds and hundreds of pilots, and the success rates that we've had helping people from everything from applying, you know, completing a CV to passing an interview process or another type of assessment process that an airline might use. And our success rates are at approximately 99% success. In fact, in all that time, we've had around 7 people not get to or through an airline selection process. So really successful. And I really, really enjoy it, Matthew, because it is a business, of course, and it's designed to make money. But personally, I really like helping people, and there's nothing more rewarding than helping someone who perhaps needs a bit of extra help and then seeing them get a job which makes a fundamental difference to them or their family.
Yeah, especially the military pilots, because we are not used to sell ourselves getting out of the military. I think we spend something like between 10 to 15 to 20 years in the military. And going back in the civilian life, where you have to sell yourself and where you have to tell to the human resources department people that you have in front of you that they have to hire you, this is not natural for us because we are not used to talk about ourselves, except fighter pilots, of course.
Yeah, especially Harrier pilots, apparently. No, you're very true. People don't like to, they feel uncomfortable about marketing their skills and their qualities, but also they just don't know how to translate that experience into qualities that the airlines are looking for. And we see a lot of that, particularly during interview training. And actually, sort of two, the interview is, can be a bit more challenging for military people, but in the group exercise, as you know, if you've been through a selection process, not everyone is going to have the same experience level. So you might have people there that are already airline pilots, maybe moving airline or having lost their jobs tragically. You might have cadets straight out of flight school and military pilots all in this group exercise trying to resolve, you know, it's a bit like a military officer training selection exercise, and all trying to resolve this problem. And they've got all these different experience levels, backgrounds, ages, genders, and watching all of the everything together, coming together is really, really interesting from my perspective. And often the military pilots struggle a little bit more in that environment because they're just so used to resolving problems the military way, and it's very, very different to how we do things in the airline world.
Especially when you're flying single seaters, when you're by your own, even if you have some wingmen, when you're a flight lead, of course you work as a team, but inside the cockpit you have to act as your own. And I think sometimes the problem is having the good switch from being a fighter pilot in a single seat aircraft to transition and being a part of the crew and first officer, of course, first of all, acting and playing with the captain. If you don't approach the problem with a good mindset, it could be sometimes a problem.
Absolutely. And, you know, having gone through military training, you know, the training is second to none. It's ruthless, as you know, and the standards are incredibly high, and there's no room for extra training to the same degree as you might be able to get it if you were purely training as a commercial pilot. Now, I should say that I've flown with commercial pilots who are easily on a par in terms of their knowledge, their operational, you know, procedures, the way they fly the aircraft, easily on a par with any fast jet pilot that I've ever flown with. So I'm not going to say for a minute that military pilots are better than the commercial pilots, because that's simply not true. But the way that we were used to doing things in the forces is very different to how you do things in the airline world, particularly as a fast jet pilot. And as you said, yeah, the way that you interact with somebody else in that cockpit, it can be a challenge for people to understand that new mentality. And even now, on occasion, you know, I have to check myself, and even if I think that somebody might be being a bit awkward with me, I have to, you know, check myself and go, is it really important? You know, what's the best way to handle this so that we keep this operation operating in as safe and as multi-crew a way as we can always? Because that's, you know, that's the most important thing.
Yeah, right. Where can we find your business? I think you have a podcast.
I do, yeah. That's very kind of you to mention. There's our 9G podcast, which I'm very flattered to be on today. Thank you, Matthew. I also I've released a different podcast, again, an aviation theme, but sort of the theme of my podcast has been about empowerment, really, and inspiring people and trying to help people understand that they can achieve this dream of becoming a pilot. And it's called For Flying Out Loud. And I've really, really enjoyed making it. I've interviewed some fast jet pilots as well, but I've also, you know, one of my most recent interviews was interviewing four female pilots from Women in Aviation International and learning more about how we can educate young women into aviation careers. So I've really enjoyed making the podcast. And the business, Flight Deck Wingman, on any social media channel or flightdeckwingman.com to find the website. I really appreciate you letting me mention that. Thank you.
Yeah, no worries. Appreciate it. Then the famous question, what's next for you, Andrew? You've been flying for the Royal Navy. You've been flying multiple commercial jets, Boeing, Airbus. You have your own company, your own podcast.
Well, those that know me will know that I'm hugely passionate about gliding. So I've been flying gliders for about 8 years. And people might laugh at me when I say this, any fighter pilots listening out there, but it's the best mix of raw flying, handling an aircraft, airmanship, weather awareness, capacity, workload management that I've ever experienced. Flying, you know, pretty fast. I mean, it doesn't really matter unless you're very close to the ground how fast you're flying, does it? Flying very close to other aircraft. And now in the last couple of years, I've got into competition flying. So perhaps racing 30, 40 other gliders, sometimes around 400, 500, 600 kilometer flights very close to them, and I absolutely love it. My ultimate ambition would be to be recognized as a top level competition pilot, but unfortunately at my age 45 now, at the incremental gains that I make each year will probably mean I'm going to be over 60 before I get to a seriously competitive level. But I'm going to try very hard.
Yeah, and I hope you'll succeed. Yeah, and the gliding as well is a very good school for the stick and rudder coordination. And in my opinion, before going to the military or before trying to be a pilot, a military pilot, you should try the glider, because this is, I think, a very good school. And as you mentioned, the awareness, the weather awareness, the handling, it's very nice to be able to experience that before joining the military.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. And I know that I think the French military, I'm not sure whether it's the Air Force or the Navy, but they do put their student pilots through some glider training. I think it's Saint-Aubin.
Saint-Provence, it's the French Air Force Academy. They put the very young officers in the gliders. I'm not sure if it's part of the official flight school, but it's something like that is in parallel. And it's in Saint-Provence, and they fly gliders.
Have you tried it, Mathieu? Have you given it a go?
Yeah. I tried the glider, and I enjoy it a lot. I was flying when I was a little bit younger, the Jodel. I don't know if you know that type of aircraft. It's a French aircraft, the Jodel D112, and that is a tail dragger, and I think it's very, very similar to the gliding, because the stick and rudder coordination on the ground in the air as well is very similar to the glider. And even if you don't have, you know, the little string in the front of the cockpit, it's kind of the same sensations. But I was lucky enough to be able to try the gliders, and it was nice, and especially because you don't hear the sound of the engine, and that makes you feeling that you really fly.
It is. Well, Neil Armstrong said it's the closest you can get to being a bird. So, and I agree with him. So, yeah, if anyone's listening, definitely go and check out some gliding. It's awesome.
Yeah, exactly. So gliders is in your aviation bucket list. For the youngsters willing to try the gliders or willing to become professional pilots, do you have any advice?
I think certainly at the moment is always have a plan B. I think it's really important to have a plan B, particularly if you're looking at the commercial world. And I think in the last few years, so many young people and people coming to flying training as a second career looked at the path to being an airline pilot and saw it as a fairly easy path that they'd finish their training and get a job. And it wasn't unrealistic, because there were lots of jobs. In the current climate, I think have a plan B, which may be short-term, no flying job at the end of training, but also look at other types of aviation, professional aviation. So perhaps being a medical emergency pilot, or flying parachute jumpers, or safari flights around Africa, because there's so many areas of aviation that you can go and get into. And quite honestly, if you're 21 years old and you've got another 44 years flying an A320, you probably wish that you'd gone and done some other fun flying beforehand. So I'd say just have a plan B, but stay motivated. It's really challenging for young people getting into this career, those in training at the moment. Of course, even more challenging for those that have lost their jobs, and not just their job, but their passion as well. Stay positive, stay motivated, and you'll make it happen.
Yeah, as well, do not hesitate to accept a job that is on the ground as well, for example, as a ground handler or whatever, because you're going to enter an aviation company. Perhaps you're going to be the next pilot of this aviation company if you take the job of a ground handler. So you can try to have some experience before going in a cockpit.
Absolutely. And of course, all of that experience, understanding other people's job roles, I don't think enough people take enough time to get to know other people's job roles. It's so fundamentally important to your future career, understanding what other people have to do, but also when if it comes to an assessment process, having that knowledge of what the rest of the team do. You don't have to know the details, every single detail, but having a good awareness of it will serve you really well when it comes to an assessment process.
We'll let the listeners check your website. And Andrew, I thank you a lot for joining me on this podcast. Thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
Merci beaucoup. It's very nice to talk to you. Excuse my poor French, but thank you, man.
No worries. Thank you very much, Andrew.